It's Monday, April 15th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Thank you, Iran. You've united a once shaky coalition behind Israel.
Israel, with the help of key Western allies, including the U.S., United Kingdom, and Jordan, were able to intercept.
The U.S. Congress is now rushing an aid bill, and the coverage emphasized the stakes and threat that Israel is under. True, there is an argument that it is a threat of their own making. I mean, why proactively kill generals who mean to kill you eventually? That thinking goes. Just leave them alone, they'll leave you alone, even if they vowed to wipe you off the earth. Maybe I'm tipping my hand a little bit about what I think of that theory. But before we unspool backwards too many degrees, my point is about world sentiment and Israel's coalition. And Iran is to thank for solidifying the latter and, however briefly, turning around the former. Next, I'd like to also thank the Iranians for pointing out that sometimes the euphemisms and cliches of things like defense industry, they're actually correct. Just think of the entire notion of defense. We changed the Department of War to the Department of Defense. Mostly that's chalked up to it being a more palatable euphemism. Sometimes we say the best offense is a good defense. But you know what? This was a case where that was absolutely valid. A good defense, like the Iron Dome and mid-air interceptions, David Sling, the Iron Beams, all those intercepts of ballistic and cruise missiles from medium to long-range rockets, it really was defense and it really worked. Without this defense, hundreds of Israelis would be dead, maybe thousands. And while that's a desirable outcome to many of Israel's enemies, foreign and within the United States, it's actually a bad outcome, even if you're entirely indifferent to Israeli life. But all you care about is American life or world stability in general. A huge death toll in Israel without the Iron Dome, without the defense, without all the countries coming together to knock those drones, suicide drones, right? Homicide, but also suicide drones out of the sky. Without all of that, there would have necessarily been a larger military response, and the U.S. certainly would have gotten involved. Let's, for a second, go back and think about that vote for Israel's defense system. A vote that Cori Bush, Ayanna Pressley, Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, Chuy Garcia, a couple others, including, let's not forget, quirky libertarian Kentucky Republican Thomas Massey, they all voted against it. Their complaint, all but Massey's, was as expressed by Rashida Tlaib on the floor of Congress.
We cannot be talking only about Israelis' need for safety at a time when Palestinians are living under a violent apartheid system and are dying from what Human Rights Watch has said are war crimes. We should also be talking about Palestinian need for security from Israeli attacks. We must be consistent in our commitment to human life, period. Everyone deserves to be safe there.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez abstained by voting present, and she cried, and she attributed her teary abstention to, quote, persistent human rights abuses against the Palestinian people. She then apologized to those in her district who would fault her for not just a flat-out no vote. She said, yes, I wept. I wept at the complete lack of care for the human beings that are impacted by these decisions. Meaning, again, the Palestinians. Literally impacted would have been hundreds, if not thousands, of Israelis if they didn't have the Iron Dome. That, thankfully, hundreds of American lawmakers saw the wisdom of. But in the framework that we heard, to those members of Congress who voted against it, there's only one group of people whose lives are at stake, Palestinians. And Israel has gone out of their way to make an enemy of just that one group of people, Palestinians. But of course, we saw there are other countries that would love to destroy Israel. What is remarkable is that those countries once included, and not so long ago, and frequently over the years, 1948, 1967, 1973, they included Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan. But even now, Jordan and Egypt will acknowledge what AOC and Rashida Tlaib will not. The utility of saving thousands of Israelis from being killed is in the interest even of those with heartfelt, deep sympathy for the Palestinians. Geopolitics is a little more complicated than simple morality tales, right? But a truly miraculous anti-missile system saving thousands of innocent lives, it's not, I don't think, that hard a call. In fact, if there were a series of missiles being lobbed at Jordan or Egypt by a hostile power, which would probably be Iran, by the way, I'm sure that an Egyptian Iron Dome, call it Pharaoh's Staff, whatever, would be welcome. But since they don't have that in place, what would happen is the United States and Israel would provide the kind of air assistance of knocking Iranian missiles out of the sky that those other countries provided to Israel and also to themselves, by the way. And if you're saying, yeah, but Egypt doesn't have an Iron Dome, why not? Oh, well, they don't need one, right? An ally of Tlaib on this issue would be quick to point out they don't need one because they're not systemically limiting the movement and freedom of an oppressed population. Except, of course, that exactly describes what Egypt does. Egypt and Israel co-manage the blockade of Gaza. It's just that Hamas doesn't regularly fire missiles to the south. So to steelman the position of the opponents of the Iron Dome. I'll pick a couple. I keep picking on Rashida Tlaib. So to steelman Cori Bush's position, Chuy Garcia's position, it's that what a no vote says is that Israel has such a bad human rights record, they don't deserve aid. They don't deserve defense. But there's actually no doctrine in the world of human rights which rob citizens of defense from mass casualties. Anytime you can achieve that, you should. So the Chuy Garcia position, you know, and the others, on Iron Dome or beam or sling might then be, ah, but a robust defense allows Israel to be more aggressive, knowing they won't pay costs in real lives, to which I say, slick theory, it is certainly not worth thousands of lives to prove. And the attacks that Israel conducts against Iranian generals and nuclear scientists, they really are targeted. They're very similar to attacks against those targets that the U.S. pulls off. And as much as the term collective punishment has become a buzz phrase, there isn't any allegation of collective punishment against the Iranians when it comes to killing a specific Quds Force leader or two. So what I'm saying here is, if there is an argument that Israel doesn't deserve an Iron Dome, don't just think about the Palestinians, think about the Iranians. And they do deserve protection from the Iranians in many ways. They're very similar to other allies of the United States. Put aside everything Israel does wrong as regards the Palestinians, put aside everything Israel does right in terms of being a democracy, freedoms, protections, all that. Just acknowledge they're a strong ally of the United States. They have a common enemy. And every other country in that position, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Indonesia, Chad, gets supported by the United States. And all those countries, I don't know if you've checked the record, the human rights record. It's not great. The point is, the entire funding, they totally ignored a real risk to Israel. A risk that left unaddressed would be horrible for the safety, not just of Israelis, but to the neighboring countries, and yes, even to you and me as Americans. In Gaza, those horrors have at least temporarily been subsumed by the reminder that there is a truly unprovoked, irredeemable enemy of Israel out there. You can't blame Tehran for wanting to strike at Israel for legitimate purposes. There was no Nakba in Iran. If anything, it went in the opposite direction. Lots of Israel's critics and enemies say Israel always has it coming. But when it comes to Iran, do they? And if the answer to that is, yeah, they do, then you'd have to say, well, certainly so does the United States. That's the bin Laden position, for instance. There's a coalition of noisy Americans, by the way, who believe that. But even in 2024, even on social media, that counts as a really radical fringe position. So I say saving lives is good. Deterring the world's worst actors is good. Utilizing foresight and technology to prevent tragic outcomes, we should all be behind it. It's one of the reasons why wealthy nations have wealth. And now we return back to Israel's other war, its internal war, where Israel's enemies aren't state-of-the-art missiles and drones. Those were 0 for 300 against Israel. No, now they have to worry about the low-touch technology of tunnels, GoPro videos, and purposeful scenes of suffering, suffering inflicted and suffering endured. That's all a much more effective means of bypassing Israel's protective measures. On the show today, a full show interview. Will Thomas is an assistant professor at the University of Michigan School of Law. He is the only person I'm aware of who predicted that Trump's civil bond would be dropped in price so Trump could pay. Today, you might have heard, Trump's criminal trial in New York begins. I hunted down, I found out, and I interviewed the person who got right key details of Trump's civil bond. We will talk about that in theories of justice as relates to Donald Trump. Will Thomas up next. Everyone will be pleased to know Donald Trump has posted bond. This is not a criminal bond. This is a bond for the New York State Court of, and they call their court such crazy things in New York, but for the appellate division to be able to hear Donald Trump's appeal of the verdict that he committed fraud against the people of the state. With interest, he was on the hook for over $500 million. He complained about that. Certainly on Truth Social, now worth much more than $500 million, but he also complained about that in a legal filing, which the court agreed with. Somewhat surprisingly, they knocked the bond down to $175 million, and through a couple of mechanisms that we could get into, he paid that bond. There was one person that I know of who predicted, more or less predicted this outcome. Right? The great debate was, is Donald Trump broke? Is he not broke? Is he just whining? Can he pay? Does he not want to pay? And one seer in the universe, and I mean seer and seer in the universe of intellectuals said, I think probably they'll knock the bond down a little so he can pay it. That was Will Thomas. He teaches at the University of Michigan School of Law. He's an assistant professor of business law, but you know what? He's kind of the ethicist in residence there. Will Thomas, welcome to The Gist.
Hey, thanks for having me on here, and thanks for the flattering if overstated introduction, but I'll take it.
That's what I do. I butter you up to just bring you down. So let's continue the buttering. Let's continue on with the slathering of allegiant. How'd you see this coming? Was it because of your rooting in ethics or because of your knowledge of bare-knuckled politics?
You know, so the court, as you mentioned, the court knocked down the appeal bond price for Donald Trump. And to me, right, the decision to do so strikes me as, it's the kind of equitable compromise that courts do a lot and that often like makes sense if you just like don't think too hard about it. Mm-hmm. Right. So if we just boil down sort of what happened, right? State of New York wins a trial against Donald Trump for roughly $350 million plus interest. Trump says he shouldn't have to pay any of this until after appeal. New York says he should pay all of it before appeal. Lo and behold, the Intermediate Court of Appeal comes along and says, well, why don't you put up $175 million, which has no, I think, substantive significance as a dollar amount.
Right, right.
Except it's
not like they said these four properties were the most serious. They didn't peg it to, you know, these are the most serious examples of fraud, so you'll just have to owe for that. It was the number, it was roughly around the number he requested.
Oh, I would say, actually, it was almost exactly half of what he lost below. Mm-hmm. So one side said zero, one side said 350, and the court comes along and says, what about 175? This is about as close as I think courts get to like a Solomonic compromise. And in some respects, that was what I was, when I was suggesting this number is going to get knocked down. I think that this is an appellate court that is trying to sort of just put to bed an issue that it sees as mostly irrelevant to its job, right? One of the things I think Donald Trump has demonstrated to be really exceptional at least as a legal actor, he's really good at taking incredibly boring, mundane, straightforward issues of procedure and, you know, civil litigation and just stretching them into long dramas. The posting an appeal bond is a fairly mundane, routine thing. And I think the Court of Appeals sort of sees it that way too. So that's a little bit why I thought they'd just knock it down to move on.
Oh, okay. So the thing that they wanted to combat his ability to create dramas and attenuate these mundane bureaucratic measures, the thing was the posting of the bond, the arguing about the posting of the bond. They just didn't want to deal with that nonsense. They thought it would be better for justice that they didn't get into that.
That is how I sort of saw this walking into it. In some respects, you know, we're in the appellate process, but since the bond has been posted, we just started. We're still at the starting line of the appeals process, even though, strictly speaking, Donald Trump has been appealing now for weeks.
In some cases, the court can't just be Solomonic, right? You have to go by procedure. Sometimes you have to go by statute. Why was this an exception?
So, yeah, we spent a lot of time with the appellate bond. So it's sort of worth thinking through what exactly is going on at the bond process. Fundamentally, what happens at appeal, right? If you want to pause a trial judgment, in other words, you don't want to pay the opposing party while your appeal is still ongoing, you have the option to do so. It's what we lawyers call furnishing an undertaking. It basically means if you provide the court some kind of guarantee that you can and will pay the judgment if you lose, then without even asking the court, you can just get an automatic pause on that judgment. So normally when we talk about appeal bonds, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the appellant's ability to stop something going forward. But of course, courts always in this space retain the ability to step in and say, we think that, you know, this should be paused for a variety of reasons. So when you look at the underlying statute in New York, all of the focus around that huge judgment, can Donald Trump raise $500 million in time? All of that was just, can Donald Trump pause his judgment without asking the court for anything? But the court always retained that ability to do this. So in my view, the Court of Appeals isn't doing anything that's not solidly within its purview here.
What was dictating that he pay 120% of judgment, and the judgment was around $450 million, so he'd have to pay a little over $500 million? Was that a guideline, a statute, or what?
So the way that the bond process works, right? Somebody else is essentially guaranteeing that you will be able to pay at the end of this. So what do you have to pay? Well, you have to pay the judgment amount. That's the right, what was ordered trial. You also have to pay what's called post-judgment interest. So right, that judgment is going to be accruing interest the entire time you wait. So when we look at an appeal bond is calculated to do a couple things. One, it's got to be enough to cover the judgment. Two, it's got to account for the time lag between the day you get the bond and the day the appeal actually wraps up. And part of that lag is going to be the risk of interest. So while there's no official statute here, there's plenty of bondsmen. It's a huge market. We've kind of worked out and said, you know, based on New York, based on these kinds of cases, we're going to require you to post a premium of, you know, anywhere from 25 to sort of 40% to make sure we're good if we get stuck paying the bills for you.
Oh, so it was the bondsmen who were setting that price.
That's correct. So the bondsmen are the ones who say, look, we're not going to give it to you at face value like any other kind of loan. We're going to have to like have a higher amount because the principal is going to be different.
Yeah, I was under the impression, and my impression was only from reading reporting and not reading anything that contradicted this, that there was a requirement or a statute that Donald Trump have to pay the full amount, or anyone in his position have to pay the full amount plus interest. I didn't, when he was appealing, I didn't realize if there was wiggle room, if he was asking for some unprecedented break on what was dictated by statute, or if he was more asking for something reasonable. And I guess it turned out to be reasonable because his appeal to reason worked. If he was asking for such something reasonable within the parameters of what was acceptable and maybe what there was some precedent for.
And this goes to this idea that I think Donald Trump is really good at shining a light on legal procedures that are in the background, right? So every state has its own a bond system. Some states have had appeal bond reform where they've put caps on these things. New York has not had something like that. But the furnishing of an undertaking usually is just usually understood to be you have to pay the whole amount. So, for example, one thing Donald Trump could have done if he wanted, he could have just paid.
Oh, by the way, let me interrupt you. The furnishing is the payment and the undertaking is the appeal. Is that how that works?
Ah, so the furnishing of an undertaking, the undertaking, you have to furnish, in other words, you have to provide evidence or support a guarantee of the undertaking. The undertaking is the payment of your obligation.
Okay, so the furnishing is the means of paying your obligation.
Right.
That's
so
what this means.
One thing he could have done, which he obviously didn't, and few people do, he could have just paid that whole, you know, $350 million plus interest.
Yeah.
Could have paid it to the state on the, you know, the day of trial.
He did that. He did the equivalent of that with the Jean Carroll bond.
So actually in the Carroll case, he's also got a bond.
Oh, okay. So he didn't pay it. He had it financed. I thought they put up like $90 million on that $80-something million.
So somebody's put up a guarantee of about $90 million
right.
on his
okay.
behalf. He, of course, it's an appeal bond. If we think of appeal bonds, bonds in general are, they're in the family of things like loans and insurance. They kind of have similar properties. So obviously, you know, he's posting collateral. He's making some payments up front to the person who's making a guarantee for him. We don't have all the details of that, but we can kind of guess based on market practice. It's not free, but it's well shy of $90 million. It's well shy of $500 million for him.
My opinion was based on just everything I read and the fact that I didn't at all see it mentioned that this was even a possibility. So what do you account for that?
So I will say one thing that is hard about some of these legal issues is in part because they're pretty mundane and uncontroversial. There's very little case law. There's very little discussion of these things. So it's hard to just grab an easy primer and figure out what's going on here. You know, if you want to know what the Supreme Court did last year, you can find a pretty good summary on those cases in Wikipedia. If you want to know how the, you know, internal mechanics of 6312 and executive laws of New York works, like, you're going to have to really do some digging. I think it's also the case that the Attorney General made the argument, which I think was ultimately successful, that actually the Court of Appeals couldn't do what it did. That, you know, it had a reading of the language of that statute that precluded them from stepping in. Now, everyone is allowed to make legal arguments, but it was very clearly a legal argument being made here. It wasn't sort of a restatement of what the rules are. It was an interpretation. And so sometimes somebody trained in this space, one time you often see in reporting is you'll see things that are arguments being made about what the law should say, being treated as what the law says.
Right. And maybe we default to when the Attorney General, who's just won the case, and at least on this score has a good track record, when the Attorney General's office is saying, no, that's not what the law is, and they've won every step of the way, perhaps the non-legal experts reporting on it just say, well, that's not what the law is.
I think it's a completely reasonable sort of default position to be coming from. And I should say, like, I don't think it was a bad argument. It's not like they were, you know.
No, they have to. I would even say they're duty bound to make the argument.
Correct.
And 6312 is this, I guess, odd, unique. Every state has their laws, but other states don't have their law that gives the Attorney General powers to investigate and prosecute cases of alleged fraud in the name of the people. So it would be. So what you're saying is there's not a lot of case law around this unique law, or which would give us a lot of insight as to what happens when someone tries to appeal a $500 million bond.
Correct. We're in such an unusual position. And one way that I think it's helpful to sort of think about what makes Donald Trump unique here. Usually when you see cases alleging this kind of systematic fraud, they don't get to the place where we are today. Right? If somebody uncovers this kind of fraud, chances are the business goes bankrupt almost immediately mm-hmm. or soon thereafter, mm-hmm. or they don't go to trial.
Right. Or they take a deal to avoid it because they know they'll go bankrupt is what you're saying.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. It happens to be that Donald Trump is the combination of somebody who is not going to settle this case, who has enough independent wealth that he can avoid bankruptcy and will refuse to declare it. And also, because it's this kind of odd family-run private business, the business itself can withstand these kinds of, frankly, no longer allegations, can withstand the public disclosure of all of its fraudulent behavior.
Right.
So it's an odd universe of weird sort of background facts that has to all line up to get us to this, which means, shocker, there's just not a lot of cases where you get all these facts lining up.
Yeah, and I'll throw another one in there. Every other business is pretty much playing the same game, which is let's maximize profits, whereas Donald Trump is playing a slightly different game. He has that business interest, but he also has let's appeal to the public, and maybe that appeal to the public or funding a sense of grievance will ultimately redound to his goals, which are probably increasing profits. But that's going on too.
That's absolutely right. And I do think, you know, it depends how you're looking at Donald Trump, because oftentimes I'll have people say, like, oh, this is working for him, or this is not working for him. You know, I think the trial and this case in general is a good example of what happens when, you know, Trump, the politician, kind of gets in the way of Trump, the defendant.
Yeah.
Because so much time and energy was spent on arguments really for public consumption that didn't have much legal bearing. And so by the time you get to trial, I think they really walked themselves into a corner where they actually didn't have a lot of good legal arguments to make to defend themselves. And that leaves Donald Trump, the businessman, owing $500 million.
Right. Although you have to weigh that against what would some hypothetical cut deal have been. And maybe they engaged in those discussions and found that it would have been in the hundred millions. And then maybe he makes the calculation, which could be, I'll take my chances at trial, or even knowing that I could be on the hook for hundreds of millions more than settling, I could get hundreds of millions in sympathetic donations or just the sympathy of my people, which could result in my election, which could result in my financial benefit. That's another calculation going on.
Absolutely right. The sort of the rational actuary prediction model of when to settle versus when to go to trial, that's hard enough when you don't have the political dimension to it. Right.
Yes.
So adding that layer on is just a level of complexity that really, you know, puts this way beyond, I think, the informed observer's ability to adequately assess.
Right. And that's why he's a lying liar who thinks the laws don't apply to him. I mean, some of that might be true, but that's not a great framework to view and evaluate what he was trying to decide in this case, I think.
I think that's exactly right. You can have political views of any persuasion about Donald Trump on, you know, on these issues. But if you really like barrel down to specific questions about like, when did we post an appeal bond or why, or what strategy they bring to trial, I would tell you that the kinds of like boring, straightforward, like 19th century rational liberal kinds of predictions are actually going to be driving 90 to 95% of the calculus.
Now, Donald Trump gives an observer a lot to work with. How closely did you follow this particular set of legal entanglements?
So I have been following the Trump organization relatively closely. My research expertise is in corporate crime, which is this kind of odd pocket of the criminal law that concerns the prosecution, the conviction of business entities themselves, as opposed to individuals. So predating this civil case, we actually had a prosecution brought by New York against the Trump organization, and that went to trial. The Trump organization was found guilty. So because I had been following that criminal trial so closely, there's a bunch of overlap in the legal concepts between this criminal and civil case. So I ended up paying a good amount of attention, although I was not, you know, at the courtroom, I wasn't listening to the full readout, but certainly I was tracking this pretty closely.
We'll be back with more from Will Thomas after the break. We're back with Will Thomas, law professor at the University of Michigan. As you were following the trial and reading or hearing coverage, was there a mix of Donald Trump and his lawyers are asserting these facially ridiculous things, and that's just one of the things he's doing for whatever reason, and they were being treated and covered as these facially ridiculous arguments, but also every once in a while, or maybe once in a great while, were saying things that had, you don't have to judge on it, but at least had legal validity and were in the realm of something to think about. So that's one half of my question. But the real question is, and did you see a flattening of those kinds of arguments in the general coverage of the trial that, you know, for someone without expertise, they would just take it, I mean, depending on their predilections, as Donald Trump's totally right or everything Donald Trump's saying is nonsense?
Right. There's lots and lots of arguments being thrown around here, some designed for public consumption, some sort of narrowly technical legal considerations. I would say that I think, in general, one challenge that any good defense team is going to have is striking the right balance between making the arguments that you think are going to be most successful in trial and making the arguments your client wants to make. And sometimes the client's arguments are good, they align with the law, but sometimes they're coming from a place of, I see why you feel this way, but I want to discourage you from going that way. I would say that the Trump defense team, or the sort of the Trump organization defendants broadly, made several legal arguments, some of which I think are good, sound arguments that are probably going to lose. Some of them are boring kind of technical considerations around things like statutes of limitations that I would tell you still have some life to them, even on appeal. Mm-hmm. And then a bunch of arguments that were categorical, over the top, profoundly bad in a way that I think ultimately really hurt them both at trial, but especially hurts them on appeal.
Mm-hmm. Was one of those, this is a victimless crime? Would that fall in that category?
I think the victimless crime kind of argument is a bit of a red herring. And I think a related argument that they made frequently was essentially like, well, there never was any fraud, mm-hmm. either because there were no errors made or because we had this disclaimer. I think those were arguments that were clearly important to Donald Trump. He spent a lot of time making them on Truth Social. I think they're somewhere between legally irrelevant and undermining of your actual own case here. Right? If you go around telling everybody I've got this disclaimer that allows me to do whatever I want, it's laying a presumption for fraud. Because why would anybody have a disclaimer so broad that they can say whatever they want in their documents unless you get to these concerns? So they really set themselves up for the kinds of arguments that the prosecutors, not the prosecutors, they set themselves up for the kinds of arguments that the Attorney General wanted to make, which I think just made that case much easier to advance.
Interesting. Why would it hurt him on appeal? Doesn't the appeal, isn't it dictated by the points that one's own legal team raises so they could just dispense with the terrible arguments they don't think are going to win?
Yeah, I think that they're going to potentially be able to jettison the arguments that they don't like. Again, this is the balance between what's going to win and what's going to satisfy the client. I do think it's always important to remember, right? A lot of people will think of appeal as like a new bite of the apple. And it's, you know, in reality, right, the appellate powers are pretty limited. Appellate courts, A, are limited to what happened below at trial, but especially they're limited to, not limited, but I would say the primary concern of an appellate court is, you know, did the trial judge identify the correct law and did they, you know, apply the correct legal framework to the facts? That's, I think, tough for the Trump folks because, at least with respect to the law, lots of the decent, solid, down-the-line legal arguments they make were considered by the highest court in New York, the Court of Appeals, annoyingly named, in, I think, 2013, in a case against AIG. And almost down the line, the court rejected those arguments. So they're good arguments, but they haven't won, at least in the past decade. That's really hard for them. Meanwhile, all of these kinds of messy other kinds of claims that the Trump folks are going to make, if Trump wants to jettison all those kind of over-the-top bad arguments, I think that leaves them in a space where they're going to be conceding that there was, in fact, lots of rampant fraud at the Trump Organization. But for technical reasons like statutes of limitations, they should not be required to pay as much. So it's not going to vindicate Trump on appeal. What it might do is it might lower the dollar amount.
Mm-hmm. Is the dollar amount unprecedented? Was AIG, were they made to pay more?
In terms of dollar amount, I think the dollar amount is, if you look at this as an individual, then the judgment amount is huge. If you look at this as a business, then no, I don't think the dollar amount is out of bounds with anything we've seen before. There's definitely been substantially larger judgments involving some companies, some non-business entities. So it's really how you frame the case. Now, how I frame the case is I look at the case caption and the case says the Trump Organization is one of the major defendants here. So to me, there's just no question. This is obviously a business case, in which case I think like there's nothing unprecedented going on here.
Gotcha. But it still is, as Donald Trump and I, as a New Yorker, would say, huge. I have to credit Donald Trump. I didn't know that that wasn't how one is supposed to pronounce huge until people started making fun of him for saying huge. Huge. You're a ethical scholar. You think about big issues. You think about corporate governance and corporate law, but you think about fairness. I'll ask you flat out, is halving the bond amount, is that an act of justice?
Interesting. So I think I would call it an act of equity more than an act of justice. In other words, whether it is just or not, the questions about like, what is the right decision to be made on behalf of the New York community and society is a question that I think is really going to be reserved for the actual substantive outcome of the appeal, right? How ought somebody be treated based on this weird combination of what they've been doing for decades, their celebrity, the reasons this case was brought, all of those kinds of messy factors. In terms of should Donald Trump be allowed to raise and vindicate those issues all the way through the litigation, that I think is much more of an equitable argument. In other words, should he be given the opportunity to sort of really push this all the way to the end of the line so that we feel confidence in what happened? That is really where the appellate bond stepped in. And I do think one thing that's going on with the Court of Appeals is they probably have in the back of their mind, look, $175 million is nothing to sneeze at. It's a lot of money. And also, this is not a person whose assets are hidden offshore or overseas and will never be found again if he loses. He has property in this state. And the thing about property is like you can't move it. So practically speaking, at the end of the day, if Donald Trump loses the maximum amount of money, is Letitia James going to be able to secure the judgment? 100%. Like it will be relatively easy and straightforward. So I think from the court's perspective, the harm of reducing that dollar amount was low to the state, and the chance of preventing them from really getting to a solid, decisive determination of the merits of this case, that was the real concern.
Because in terms of equity, we have to perform the mental task of separating who we know or believe Donald Trump to be outside the context of this case. It doesn't matter if he said horrible things about broad swaths of the world's population or pursued policies that we morally object to or morally love, right? We have to do that. And the equitable thing is the question, should someone be able to pursue their appeal, which is a right and something that the justice system is based on, should someone be allowed to pursue or denied the opportunity to pursue their appeal based on this monetary set of circumstances? Am I characterizing it fairly?
I think that's exactly right. So if you remember back, this was several years ago, right? Gawker Media gets sued by Hulk Hogan, sure. Huge judgment against them. It was at the time a kind of big issue, but Gawker could not pay their appeal bond. They literally didn't have the assets to go forward. Now, ultimately, that case ended up sort of settling at the appellate level. The company had to go bankrupt anyway. But I think people had like the natural instinct that maybe they thought the outcome of the trial was fair, but they really thought what was unfair is that Gawker had good reason to appeal and like could not actually afford to appeal.
Right.
Now, can Donald Trump actually afford this? Like, that's one of the tricky things about him is he's switches between businessman and legal defendant all the time. Sometimes he says, I could never pay more than $100 million. And lo and behold, the next day he shows up with $175.
Well, what is afford? I mean, afford is such a it's such a shaky word. Who knows what afford means?
That's right. You know, there's always bankruptcy. People besmirch bankruptcy is the worst thing, but it's the whole point of it is starting fresh. I don't see why.
He's done it. I mean, some of his assets have been put into bankruptcy. But do you think, I want to ask you that. I mean, this is less the ethicist and less the lawyer and more the business hat that you wear. Do you think this says anything about his underlying financials, how much money or cash or assets he actually has? Because I'll put my, I don't know if you've heard past segments, I said that Donald Trump doesn't want to pay, but if he had to, if he didn't get this $175 million judgment, I was confident he'd be able to pay. I don't know where he'd get the loan. I don't know if he'd get the loan. I don't know if he'd have to take a mortgage on Mar-a-Lago. I thought that he was so committed to appealing and believes that he'll at least get some of the money knocked down, that he'd find a way to pay. But to go back to my original question, can we draw any proper inferences about the strengths of his underlying financials from the fact that he pursued this ultimately successful lowering of the bond?
I think I fall in the same camp you do, right? In other words, we can take what people say as evidence of what is true. We can also take their actions as evidence of what is true.
Yes.
One thing I see reported often is Donald Trump had $350 million of cash, which is not enough to pay the whole amount. It's true that he said that in a deposition in this trial. It's also true that he said lots of observably false things during that deposition. In fact, many of them were laid out in the trial. So it's hard to credit that fact. At the same time, you're dismissive of others. Likewise, you know, I think if we followed the Eugene Carroll's appeal, right? The Trump defense was making a lot of the same arguments. Like, we have to pay $90 million. That's a huge amount of money. Who can afford that? They were making those arguments on a Thursday afternoon, and on Friday morning, they posted a bond for $90 million. So it's a little bit hard to take either his assertions or his practices at face value. I think I have the background thought you do as well. He seems to just be able to like generate money, and I don't quite know how. So that superpower, I think, is probably still in effect, but I guess we'll never know.
Yeah. So I want to ask you one bigger last question. I think it'll be the last avenue to pursue. So in so many realms, Donald Trump is, I think, credibly considered both the cause and the outgrowth. Nastiness, the coarsening of public discourse, embracing of conspiracy theories, right? Did Donald Trump make it worse? Well, yes, you could say in many of these aspects he did. But was Donald Trump propelled by the fact that this is where our society is? Also true, cause and effect. So I want to ask you about your area of expertise, corporate ethics. Is Donald Trump's success, he was president, do you sense that? Do you pick up that having an effect on how seriously corporations take adherence to the law and the acceptability of, say, ripping off the public? Do you look at Donald Trump's ability to navigate as he has and accrue great fortunes based, this court has now adjudicated to be ripping off and committing fraud. Where do you stand on the Donald Trump cause or effect of corporate chicanery question?
Interesting. So there's a couple ways to think about this question. One is, are sort of corporate executives and leaders today looking at the Donald Trump model and thinking this is how we ought to do it? There, I'm a little skeptical, in part because if you asked me to sit down and write how to do the Donald Trump business model, I can't even begin to imagine. It's so fundamentally driven by this like odd pre-existing wealth, this outspoken personality that I think it's a really hard thing to do well. And meanwhile, it seems like the ways in which you fall off the model can be like existential.
Yeah, you're right. It's like, right? Step one, really, go back to the 1980s, get on the cover of the New York Post a lot. Like, that's going to be hard for most people.
That's totally right. And also, so many things he's doing, we see similar kinds of like, you know, outspoken brazen activities being engaged in. That usually ends up in prison. So if the business model is succeed like Donald Trump or go to jail, I think any rational business actor is going to say like, great, that's a broken business model. You know, on the other hand, the bigger worry that I have around this stuff is particularly for, you know, for younger individuals. One thing we know is when it comes to sort of moral and cognitive development, one thing that we do, particularly younger in life, is we kind of reverse engineer our ethics from role models. So we look at somebody, how somebody behaves in the world, and then we like extrapolate back what's acceptable behavior. So when we see folks like Donald Trump, and we see folks like Elon Musk going out there and doing things that I would say are sort of undermining of settled norms around like fair and ethical business practices and succeeding, then it's natural to draw like the wrong instinct from students. In fact, I'll give an anecdote without naming the student, but when Donald Trump was first facing an impeachment, I was teaching some just basic legal principles, including something like quid pro quo in the context of harassment litigation. And I had a student come to me afterwards in class and say, you know, professor, I don't understand this law about quid pro quo that you just taught me. Because if that's what the law is, then it sounds like what Donald Trump did was a quid pro quo. But that can't be right. And I thought, like,
it can't be right. He's saying because he's never held accountable for that.
Exactly, he didn't do that. It's a perfect example of like logical reasoning, except like we got the conclusions flipped, right? The answer was somebody got it wrong, as opposed to that's not how this concept works. So that's the kind of corrosive worry I have. It's that these kinds of like over the top practices are going to bleed back into how people see sort of successful role models in society. And that's going to be like the source of long-term, I would say, degradation.
Will Thomas is an assistant professor of business law at the Stephen M. Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan. And he looks into the normative and conceptual foundations of corporate and white-collar crime. Wait, what's that mean? What it means is what you just heard. Thank you so much, Dr. Thomas.
Thanks for having me on here.
That's it for today's show. The Gist is produced by Corey Wara. The senior producer is Joel Patterson. Michelle Pesca is CLO of Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Umpru, gpru, dupru, and thanks for listening.